Good afternoon, and welcome to Bingham Presents 2013 Asset Management, broadcast live from Bingham McCutcheon LLP's offices in New York and online at www.sechistorical.org. I'm Arthur Laby, professor of law at Rutgers University School of Law and moderator for this program. This event is the fifth in the Bingham Presents series, and it is made possible through a partnership between Bingham McCutcheon and the SEC Historical Society. With close to 1,000 lawyers in offices on three continents, anchored by major commitments in the world's key financial centers, Bingham McCutcheon offers market-leading practices focused on the financial services industry. Bingham lawyers provide global intelligence to help clients understand how capital markets fit together. The SEC Historical Society, through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org, shares, preserves, and advances knowledge of the history of financial regulation. I am a member of the Society's Board of Advisors and serve on the Museum Committee, advising on the growth and outreach of the virtual museum and archive. Since the inaugural Bingham Presents broadcast in 2009, the series has examined such issues as criminal enforcement of the securities laws, harmonization of the regulation of investment advisors and broker-dealers, and enforcement after the Dodd-Frank Act. All of the previous Bingham Presents broadcasts are available in both audio and edited transcript formats in the Bingham Presents section under Programs in the Virtual Museum and Archive. I encourage you to check them out at the end of this broadcast. The SEC Historical Society is grateful for the continuing generous sponsorship of Bingham for the series. This evening, we will be examining asset management. Joining me are three distinguished panelists: Buddy Donahue, Managing Director at Goldman Sachs and a former Director of the SEC's Division of Investment Management; Tom Harmon, Partner here at Bingham and formerly Chief Counsel and Associate Director in the SEC's Division of Investment Management; and Nancy Morris, Chief Compliance Officer at Wellington Management Company and formerly Secretary of the SEC and Deputy Chief Counsel in the Division of Investment Management. I wanted to start off our discussion with what is perhaps on everyone's mind, and that is the emphasis on enforcement, both at the SEC and criminal enforcement. It seems like we're seeing more enforcement activity, particularly in the asset management area. So I'd like to start and get our panelists' view on what do you think about some of the recent enforcement cases that have grabbed headlines? What do they represent? Is there anything new or different here? So why don't we start with Tom, and of course we'll hear from the others soon.
Okay. Thank you, Arthur. It's a pleasure to be here. I guess I'd say this is my personal view is that there's something new, there's something old here in terms of maybe what's not new. I think the continued emphasis in cases like Stephen Cohen on insider trading is a persistent theme and thread throughout the SEC's activities of the last 30 years. So while the names and perhaps some of the details will change from case to case, this shows to me the resolve and the determination of the staff and the commissioners, in particular the enforcement division, to continue to pursue insider trading as it manifests itself. The something that's clearly new is the emphasis on what I guess I would call structured securities cases, whether they're CLOs, CBOs, CDOs, swaps, or what have you, where there's a security present. I think the other case involves a determination by the SEC to leave its mark on some of these complex securities and the ways in which they were both assembled and marketed. So that's the way I would sort of take a first stab at a high level.
Tom, let me ask you a follow-up question, or any of the others may respond as well. So you mentioned one example, which is insider trading. Do you think advisory firms should be really reconsidering their approach to some of the old problems like insider trading, or should they be looking at this the way they have in the past, or does this new emphasis on enforcement indicate that perhaps they need to rethink the way they address those problems?
Oh, I think that they should be, and in fact they are continuing to sort of think through the sort of what they're doing and how they do it today against the backdrop of concerns that are out there. Obviously, in the area of like expert networks, for example, asset management firms, whether they're mutual fund shops or whether they're hedge fund shops. The use of expert networks is something that they need to be thinking about, and thinking about the law of insider trading as those two things overlap.
Nancy, do you have any views on this?
Sure. I'm looking at sort of the enforcement. There's nothing really all that new in my view about insider trading cases. It's always been the predominant case that the SEC has brought. But what is a little bit new, I think, are the sort of aggressive techniques that are being used now to investigate insider trading. We've all heard of the things like wiretapping, sort of deep photo shoots from afar, showing cash exchanging hands, et cetera. So I think there's a renewed emphasis on it, which makes it important when you're in-house and certainly when you're a chief compliance officer. And so I'm focusing on what should I be doing, let's say, as a CCO in terms of compliance for the firm. So I look at sort of the cases like the Hyde Analytics issues. That's a whole new area of political intelligence that we really haven't seen much of before. Also the expert network area. What are the things that I can do in-house, for example, as an asset manager to make sure that my firm stays on the right side of that line? And those things can include things like, negotiating with your third-party service providers to ensure that they understand what your position is, that you don't want to receive MNPI, that you perhaps don't want to talk with folks who've been recently employed by a company, certainly in a senior-level position. The other thing that I sort of sit back and look at are things like the Steve Cohen and the SAC Capital case. And so I wrote some notes down on this. And I think for me in-house and sort of talking with the people that I work with and talking with others in the industry, I have two main lessons out of this already, and the case really isn't, it's just been brought. And that is that a firm's success or survival really depends on the integrity of its personnel, and that the gains associated with insider trading are quite fleeting, but the damage done to a firm's reputation is permanent. Clients will not take a chance on an investment manager whose sort of ethical integrity is called into question. The other thing is that there is no room, I think, in the business for a see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil approach. Investment advisors are fiduciaries, and as such, that case tells me we have to speak up if we see something going on.
I have a somewhat different, not necessarily different, but I think a nuance really to some of the cases, because and others on the panel may have greater insight to this, but the case against Cohen is a supervisory case.
Yeah.
Failure to supervise. For the firm, the responsibility under the law, under the Advisors Act, to have policies and procedures specifically to address insider trading and to help prevent it and detect it. I think should be a wake-up call to everyone. I think, this isn't just that the guy who did it is going to get hit and that the firm might have some responsibility relative to the gains that might have come from that. But individuals may have responsibility because they failed to carry out their duties in terms of supervising the people that actually engaged in the insider trading. And I thought that was some of the significance that came out of the Cohen case. Now, you also could say, well, geez, I guess that's all they could get him on, even though there seems to have been, several significant insider trading cases within the same firm. But that was one of the takeaways that I had, which was that they're looking at the structure that's there and who's responsible for overseeing to make sure these things don't happen. Did they ignore red flags? Did they do the things that one would expect they should do, or that they had to do really under their policies?
I would agree with you there, buddy. I think that's in the context of supervision, this is going to be a very powerful case, and will really drive home to managers in the industry that they have to know what their people are doing and that they have to supervise them properly. And that just doesn't go to sort of supervising them from a line function. It goes to things like, are they complying with your code of ethics? Are they complying with your insider trading policies, let alone doing the job that they're supposed to be doing? So I agree with you there.
Yeah, in the failure to supervise case, failure to supervise has become sort of like the all-purpose tool in the toolkit the last 20 or 30 years. I mean, I won't say virtually every, but I'd say a large number of the SEC enforcement actions over the last 25 or 30 years include a failure to supervise. There's a variety of reasons for it, I think, because I think as a former SEC person, I think it just sounds good that to be able to say, well, this is what we're sanctioning them for. I think from a standpoint of more flexibility, I think there's a number of reasons why it's the all-purpose tool in the toolkit, but it's something that everyone should keep in mind because it is sometimes the only charge that that may be left at the end of the day when the settlement is signed.
Tom, they've been less frequent in the advisor space, obviously, than they have in the broker-dealer space. That has a more structured rule-based, responsibility of supervisors for supervising those that are directly under them. And many asset managers are not set up in a way that you could immediately identify who is the supervisor for a particularly in a portfolio management area, where they're collaborative and where they, and that doesn't mean that it doesn't apply. I think it's been less on top of mind, I think, on the asset management side of the business than it has on a broker, certainly than on the broker-dealer side of the business.
Well, I'd agree with you that on a couple of things, like the whole duty to supervise, really, it's in the Advisor Act because it's literally carved out of the 34 Act and dropped into the Advisors Act. But if you go and look at a lot of the pricing cases in particular, all the 22C1 cases where portfolio managers sort of corrupted or tainted the system by which securities were valued every day, portfolio investments, there's oftentimes a failure to supervise in the litany of things that the settlement is eventually wrapped around.
Let me just ask one follow-up question about supervisory responsibility, because it's a very important topic, and I'm glad that we're focusing on it. Regulators, as you know, have always relied on a firm's own in-house supervisory system. As we've said, it's a critical part of the regulatory system. And I was wondering if each of you could just reflect for a moment on whether you think that system is really working, whereby firms are the first-level supervisors of their own conduct. Is that a system that is working well? And, of course, I'm asking that just on the heels of our prior discussion about enforcement. I'd like to get each of your perspectives, or at least some perspectives, on whether the system, more generally, as a systemic matter, is working well.
I guess your suggestion would be that perhaps some sort of external supervision would be appropriate. I think it can totally work in-house at a firm. I think it just, depending on the size of the firm, et cetera, it has to be structured appropriately. I think it's important for people to understand if they are a supervisor. It's important for them to understand what it is they're supervising. It's important for them to document what their supervisory role is and to sort of document what it is that they have to do in order to meet that. But that's a first line function. I think firms have multiple layers of supervision, including committees that oversee activities, and those committees are oftentimes independent from the area that they're looking at, or certainly cross-departmental sort of committees that can, I think, recognize and appropriately curb, behavior that they think is perhaps moving in the wrong direction. So if the inference is that we have to go to an external source to oversee it, I'm not sure I agree with that. Number two, I guess the other alternative would be some sort of a self-regulatory organization to oversee the industry. That's also something that I'm not entirely keen about, mostly because I think it would create enormous and additional costs without necessarily having great benefit. And I would argue the SEC could do more in this area to provide greater guidance on what they expect.
Any other views on that topic?
Well, I echo that point, but I think it really has to be in-house. Compliance is really owned by the firm. And the sense that somehow you could take the regulatory requirements and outsource them really says that function is owned by someone else.
And it's the, and I, you know, I think the more systems are used in order to try and ensure compliance, the more people think of it as being compliance's responsibility for making sure bad things don't happen, when the reality is it's the business's responsibility to make sure bad things don't happen. And compliance has some tools to help the business do that. So I think it has to be part of the business, and it would anyway, even if you said you have to outsource it. You don't want someone else finding that, in fact, you have problems. And internally, that's the only way you can identify conflicts, the only way you can deal with the issues that you need to deal with. And the solutions to those are not easy and are different for different firms based on the structure of the firm.
Yeah, I'd agree emphatically with Buddy and with Nancy. I think that, in fact, with some clients, we've seen the compliance people personnel sort of embedded in each of the different segments of the business as opposed to being a separate office of compliance or something like that. So I think that's really taken sort of taken the notion of who owns it to its logical conclusion, which is every different business segment within an advisor firm or a broker-dealer firm or whatever should have its own compliance expert, sort of the boots on the ground, sort of handling the questions in real time. Otherwise, you know, everyone else is just coming in after the fact, sort of sweeping it up and trying to fix it. And that's oftentimes far more expensive than catching it more or less in real time.
Thanks, Tom. So we've been talking about this emphasis on enforcement, and I'd like to ask about the other side of the coin of that emphasis on enforcement. It seems that the emphasis on enforcement might mean a de-emphasis on the division of investment management and other operating divisions at the SEC. I wanted to see if I could get your comments on whether you think that's right. Is the role of the division changing as a result of the emphasis on enforcement? And just ask what you envision in the next several years, 2, 3, 5 years or longer, for the division in light of recent events in the enforcement area. Buddy, do you want to start on this one?
Yeah, I'd like to start.
One of the things, my sense was that, you know, there's a significant increase in the relative resource of the commission that were devoted to enforcement and to OC, you know, relative to other divisions. And so I said, okay, well, that's an interesting thesis, but what are the facts? And so I went back and looked. And in 2004, there were 54% of the people that worked in the SEC worked in either OC or in enforcement. And in the budget for 2014, so 10 years, the resources, meaning the people inside the SEC, 54% are in OC and enforcement. Now, I would have lost a lot of money on a bet. And what you don't see coming through is actually the amount of resources that were then split between OC and enforcement. OC's won. Enforcement went down from in 2000 and 4. You know, they to 2014, they went up 13%. They originally had 32%. They're down to 29% of the staff. OC went from 22% of the staff up to 25%. So my instinct was wrong. Now, maybe if I picked different periods, but I figured 10 years was a fair period to pick, and I didn't feel like doing, you know, a lot of research on it. But I thought it – but I like to test what my instincts are and – really like it when I get borne out. I'm not so happy when I'm not borne out. But I think what it bears, but I think what we're feeling is what's happened in the asset management area in terms of the devotion of resources, particularly in enforcement, to the asset management industry. And that therefore our perception is driven by that, not by actually the headcount that exists inside the commission. And, you know, we could talk later if you want, Arthur, about that and what some of the drivers might be and what some of the facts might be. But it actually isn't an allocation of resources by the SEC. In fact, they've decreased relatively the human part of the allocation of resources from enforcement and moved them to OSI, which is one way to look at it.
Nancy, Tom, do you see that in your practices?
I guess that's interesting. I think the number game is interesting, although I don't know if that necessarily translates into an emphasis or de-emphasis one way or the other. I think those priorities ultimately are set by the chairman, and there seems to be a great emphasis.
Well, it is true that enforcement guys only do enforcement.
Right, right, where I am does. But I think where I see sort of an emphasis or de-emphasis, how you want to look at it, is really Dodd-Frank regulation has really required the Division of Investment Management to devote the vast majority of its resources to trying to get those rules and regulations out the door. It's going to be that way for a few years. So I think other areas might feel or suffer from some neglect absent some other kind of scandal coming to the forefront, which would then reprioritize division resources.
Yeah. And by the way, on the metrics that I had just given, Investment Management Division went from 4.6% of the number of people down to 3.9%. So there was a relative decrease in terms of number of the amount of the resources from the SEC that are being devoted to investment management.
Buddy, you mentioned Chair White. And
by the way, that's probably the end of my stats.
We won't call on you for more stats.
I have some.
You mentioned Chair White, and as you know, she was confirmed for a second term ending in 2019. Wanted to ask each of you if you've seen changes at the commission since April 2013 that reflect her arrival. Wondering if you could just comment briefly on how perhaps her background might influence her tenure and what you've seen so far. Tom, have you seen anything yet that you could point out to us?
No, it's not clear to me, you know, 6 months in, sort of what it's going to, what her chairmanship is going to be remembered for. But my guess is, given her incredibly strong experience, that she's going to feels very comfortable with, and will probably continue to feel very comfortable in the enforcement realm. And one could reasonably presume that she will leave a strong footprint there.
Nancy, Buddy?
Yeah, I would agree. I don't think I have much more to offer there. I think it is too sort of early in the term, other than, as Tom said, we know she has a very strong enforcement background, would expect to see that manifest itself, certainly. There's no question she's extraordinarily energetic and a real quick learner and really focused on the business of the commission. So it'll be interesting to see.
I think early signs are good. You know, if you look at some of the things that she's already gotten done, I think, you know, things that had been difficult prior to her arrival, whether you like it or not, the money market fund proposal did get out, and it got out with pretty strong support. Now, she has two new commissioners, and I think that's a new challenge that she has. And so it is too early to tell, except that I think, you know, early signs are that, and you know, from what little I've heard, I don't go around asking. So, but it seems like there's some pretty good cooperation among the commissioners, which really is a key to whether or not she'll be successful.
Nancy, you had mentioned Dodd-Frank just a few moments ago. So this week, as you know, marks the fifth anniversary of the collapse of Lehman. Dodd-Frank is just over 3 years old. The focus was really not primarily on asset managers in Dodd-Frank, but there are plenty of issues relevant to funds and advisors. I'd ask each of you if you could comment on your view of the law, what effect you think it's having on the operating divisions at the SEC as far as you know. Nancy, you alluded to this earlier. Could we start with you, and then I'd ask the others to comment as well.
Put out a couple. One, I think the agencies, it's not only the SEC, it's the CFTC, it's other agencies and governmental office are still quite mired down in trying to get Dodd-Frank implemented. On balance, if you ask me, I hope we'll be better off when everything is said and done. But to be honest, there's just still so much that has yet to be done that it's hard to say. It is what it is, whether it's going to be good or bad. We certainly have to, you know, live with it. I think it is creating, I think, huge operational and issues for in-house investment managers. These rules and regulations are coming fast and furious, and they keep coming and coming and coming. And it's not only in the U.S., it's in Europe and in Asia as well. And so sort of synthesizing everything, getting it right, making sure you understand the nuances of all these new regulations coming out will require a lot of in-house resources, certainly for the next several years, I think. And, you know, certainly one of the concerns I would have is that all these new regulations will obviously be a source for potential enforcement action, and I would hope that's not the case. But given the volume of regulation, you know, you can certainly see it happening.
I guess I'd say a couple observations from my perspective. One, at a macro level, I think that Dodd-Frank and its emphasis on making changes in the derivatives and swaps and futures markets may bring a certain greater transparency and sort of safety to that world. And insofar as money managers and their pool funds of varying sorts are in those markets, that might be a better thing, although there will certainly be, you know, a cost to all of that, all those improvements. At a more granular level, I think that the staff of the Investment Management Division has spent a lot of time drafting and the SEC commissioners have spent a lot of time sort of adopting various rules for investment advisors, sort of drawing lines here, drawing lines there, new disclosure forms, and it not just, as Nancy says, sort of creates all of these new regulations for investment managers. It has sort of soaked up a huge chunk of staff time in the Investment Management Division.
You know, I felt really proud of the division. They actually got pretty much all their work done on time. They had some short time frames for some of the studies they had to complete, which were not easy studies to do. They had certain rulemaking they had to do, and pretty much they got it done very quickly. And so I don't think that's a drag on them anymore. I think there's some residual from that. But there's a drag in the whole commission. You know, if you think about In your own experience, if you have a board of directors and they only have so much time, right, and you have something that's important to get done, but they have stuff that's urgent, you know, and for the SEC's case, that might be certain actions that they have to take that are mandated by law, you have to have something really, really important and urgent in order to get time on the agenda. So no matter how much the division works on something that's really important, and maybe really important long term, unless it's on that agenda, it's not going to get done. And I think that's, you know, when you talk about, you know, the taking up staff time and everything, I think, you know, that is one of the impacts that's going to be felt for a long time, which is the backlog of important things that the division and other divisions have been working on that would improve situations and that they're not going to be acted on because they don't have the priority, however important they might be. And I think that's, That really is a shame. A couple points that I have, and these are my personal views on Dodd-Frank. I worry about the amount of power that's being given to the Fed, and the fact that you're going to wind up with potentially all the big banks moving in the same direction at the same time, and you know they're not all knowing. And so I do worry about, their increased involvement, really, in many areas that they had not been in before. I do worry that there's a view of many, I don't know that they necessarily state it this way, but it's about reducing risk. And I have a fear that actually I haven't reduced it, I've just moved it.
Well, I don't have the statistics, buddy, but I think the statistics that have been generated to date show that the too big to fail is a even greater fear because there are fewer and larger banks today. So if that was one of the chief goals of Dodd-Frank, it hasn't been achieved.
The idea that somehow you can take risk out of marketplaces, I mean, that's where you get your returns. The question is, are the right people taking the risk? Do they know about it? Do they have the wherewithal to deal with it?
And I'm not sure that's that well understood. I worry about where the liquidity is going to be, really, for the marketplaces, whether or not there's really going to be dealers out there that have the capability of making markets in the markets that are necessary. And will they have the capital, and will they be permitted to use the capital at the time that the financial markets really do need it?
That's already obviously affecting the markets right now.
Yeah, it's very tough. You know, some of that may be a reflection of Dodd-Frank. Some of it may have occurred in any event as, you know, others who might not have some of the regulatory requirements were jumping in and, in effect, taking the kind of the easy trades.
Right.
And leaving the more difficult trades to others. So, you know, I look at the impact on investment management. I think some of the changes, particularly, you know, moving my own personal view, you know, many of the advisors that previously had been eligible really for an exclusion now came within the purview of registering with the SEC. And I think that, you know, having had the job I had, and I'm sure the jobs you had, I mean, that was always a gap that we felt when we were there.
Yeah, let me ask the panel about that. So I think that's an important point, buddy.
Can I take over asking the questions and you can answer them often?
That's not the way it works today. But good try. So, as you know, the SEC, of course, now oversees private fund advisors that register with the SEC as a result of Dodd-Frank. That, as you say, is a major change. And I wonder if you could each just reflect for a second on what do you think of that? Will registration really make a difference? And how is it going? Is the industry, to the extent that you know, transitioning well to a regulated industry? This is a major change as a result of the Dodd-Frank Act.
So I have some numbers, buddy. I just took a – apparently
– you each did your homework. I did a little homework here.
So more than 1,350 new registrants have come in and registered with the SEC as an investment advisor. There are more than 30,000 private funds with total assets in excess of $8 trillion. So has it made a difference? Well, we obviously have a whole lot more investment advisors that are registered with the SEC. Do I think it will make a difference? I do. I think, first and foremost,
do you have a lot more? They're just different as a based on Dodd-Frank. They moved a lot to the states.
Oh, sure. There's a whole group that went to the states, and there's a – but it just – in terms of
numbers.
In terms of private funds, though, under the SEC's purview, certainly under their ability to gain access to information about those funds and how they're managed and what their risk profile are, they obviously have information that they've never had before. I think it will be interesting to see how they – slice and dice that information. It's a lot of information. If you look at the ADV Part 1s in particular, they have ballooned for private fund managers. They're thousands of pages long now. I went to download some. Assuming you can even pull it up because they're so big, it's hard to actually even pull them up. But will it make a difference? I think so. I think there is a discipline associated with registration. I think the requirement to have a chief compliance officer and a code of ethics begins to sort of introduce advisors to that culture that you certainly hope they will have as a fiduciary. I just think it's a more disciplined approach to how you look at your business from a fiduciary and compliance point of view. So in the long run, yes. In the short run, and I also think enforcement will make a big difference there as well.
I guess I'd agree with all that, but I'm personally still kind of scratching my head in the sense of we're talking about accredited investors or qualified purchasers or whatever the institutional type of investor is that typically predominates these funds. And you can kind of scratch your head and say, well, I thought the SEC should be spending the vast majority of its budget, you know, reviewing, inspecting, enforcing against, you know, more retail products whose investors can't protect themselves. So,
there are a lot of sophisticated.
Were you there for the Madoff hearings?
Yeah.
I was.
No.
Well, Tom, that's actually a great point. I mean, if you're willing to do it, I might ask the panelists if they might just reflect on that for a second. I mean, you raise a very sort of fundamental question of the role of regulation and the role of the SEC, and there are many who take that view that with respect to qualified purchasers or accredited investors, that perhaps the SEC ought to forbear and not be as involved and spend much more of their resources protecting individual investors, smaller investors. That's certainly a reasonable approach to take.
Yeah, so, I have nothing against protecting dentists or doctors.
Tom, is your point that if you're an advisor to rich people, you shouldn't have to register? Because that was never the rule. So it's not the advisor registration that's the driving point. Is it the collection of the data, which is then going to be used by FSOC?
Let me put a little finer point on that. To the extent that we're worried about unregulated and opaque pools of capital, such as hedge funds, swinging around into the markets and disrupting things, then Form PF, for example, gives the SEC some information about what those hitherto unregistered advisors are doing. So that's probably a good thing from a macro level. But the whole notion of the SEC spending lots of taxpayer dollars to make certain that all of the rich doctors and dentists, that they're the advisor of their fund, that he did exactly what he or she said they were going to do in their offering memorandum, and that sort of stuff just leaves me thinking like, somewhere along the line, I missed something because I'm not sure this makes a whole lot of sense. When Nancy and I were chief counsel and deputy chief counsel back when dinosaurs roamed the earth, and people came in asking about the 100-person fund exemption or whatever, it's like, let's just get this letter out because this is just, this isn't where retail America is investing. And so, they were interesting letters, but I'm not sure that was the essential mission of the SEC. After all, these private funds are premised in part on private offerings under the whole 33 Act rubric of, sophisticated investors who can fend for themselves and don't need the protection of the SEC. So it just seems to me like somewhere along the line, the message in some ways has gotten a little mixed up. If it's these professional money managers have a huge impact on the capital markets, I get that part.
Yeah. I guess there is a disconnect there in terms of potential use of resources. But I would point out that, the utilization of Reg D gets you out of 33 Act, does get you out of the Advisors Act. So what would you say, the Advisors Act then doesn't apply if you're doing a private fund? Is your point more, which I think it probably is, that if you have limited resources, which everyone does, that you ought to be devoting them to protecting those people that can't afford to protect themselves.
That's my point. And to the extent that you've got 1,300 new registered advisors who are coming in because they're managing accredited investors' monies or more robust, and the SEC, OC is going to be examining a certain number of them, they can't just ignore them because they're on their rolls. So the end of the day, those hedge funds and whatnot are going to be occupying a certain percentage of the SEC's brain space, and those aren't the mutual funds and the ETFs and the other things that retail and Americans are investing either their pension assets or their discretionary assets in.
And Tom, to your point, OC is going to spend a disproportionate amount of time in those areas because of their risk-based approach.
Right, and because they're new and interesting, and so they will get more, and because the OC people will be concerned that they will be called forth to produce a letter to Congressman so-and-so, a report to so-and-so and so-and-so on this new segment of the industry that they now have responsibility over for. So in my mind, it's inevitable that these advisors and their hedge funds will take up more space where previously they occupied, very little space.
And of course, the anti-fraud provisions continue to apply whether somebody's registered or not. Nancy, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say they certainly have accounted for, potentially, I could be wrong about this, but a disproportionate number of cases involving insider trading, fraud on the market, et cetera. So
the other fear of many inside the commission is that if you have data and don't use it,
yes,
you're in trouble.
I wanted to.
You may not have known, but you could have known because the data is there. And shame on you for not looking at it.
So I wanted to change gears slightly and talk, drill down a little bit deeper on a couple of other issues. One question that I wanted to ask you about is innovation. Anytime new rules are passed, one worries about the effects of those rules on innovation. You three are very experienced. Somebody earlier on this panel mentioned ETFs. I'm wondering if you could just reflect for a second on that idea. What does it take to launch a new product? And do new rules, in some cases, do they act as an impediment in some respects to launching new products? Tom, do you want to start us on this one?
Sure. I think, you know, ETFs is an interesting example because I was at the commission when some of the first ETFs sort of passed through the portals, and that was 20-some years or so ago. So here we are, and you still need a series of startup exemptions to get up and running as an ETF. So there's been, you know, there has been innovation, and there's been more ETFs over these last 20 years, and they've gone from being purely an equity product to fixed income as well, and we're sort of poised on the cusp of potentially rules in the next couple of years that will sort of do away with the need for all these startup exemptions. But it just feels like it takes a long time.
You know, interesting. I agree with you, Tom. I do think that innovation continues regardless. People adapt to whatever it is that ultimately, you know, comes out in the form of rules or regulations. But I have seen people pull back from product development. And a perfect area is actually the whole SEC, CFTC, mutual fund, CPO registration. A lot of funds are pulling back and don't even want to get close because they don't want to trigger that CFTC registration. And so they are specifically making products that are going to fit within a strict 40 Act mold that will not in any way, shape, or form sort of go over into that CFTC space. And so we're probably going to not see some innovative products that we might otherwise have seen from some of those entities, but they just, at least at this point, so unsure about the uncertainties of how the regulatory frameworks are going to interact with each other, although that is becoming a bit clearer now. But I thought that was kind of interesting to see a lot of people just pull back and say, don't even go close.
I probably have a different perspective. The biggest impediment that I see to innovation is uncertainty.
Yeah,
it's not a new rule where you know what it says, you know how it applies. It's rather the uncertainty about how something is going to be viewed, and particularly, you know, where you have grave concerns about, you know, how OC might view it or how the enforcement asset management unit might view it. And it's not that you don't think that what you're proposing is grounded in the law. You may never get to make the argument. That may be irrelevant by the time that it comes up unless you're willing to go to the mat on something. So what I see is in coming up with new product development that the uncertainties that are out there have been an impediment to developing many new products. The uncertainties about how you treat derivatives when you put them into new products and exactly how it's going to be viewed going on, you know, is an impediment to many of the newer products where people have been trying to move over some good products that exist in the private fund world and put them into the registered fund arena so that they can make them more readily available to other investors or alternatively to the same investors but with the protections that are built into the 40 Act. That's where I've seen, you know, many of the biggest challenges, which is how do we make sure that, in fact, what we're proposing is, when viewed with hindsight, 10 years from now, everybody's going to say, yeah, that was okay, as opposed to you should have known that on a principles basis that somehow that is, you know, not appropriate. And that's the way a lot's being viewed in terms of, okay, what happened?
How do we address that? I mean, inherent then in innovation is uncertainty. So what are some possible ways that we can address that uncertainty, or is it just inherent in innovating new products? And there's no way around it.
Well, I think the way that in the past many have addressed that is that they would have come to investment management and gone to to Tom or Nancy and said, listen, you know, here's the issues I'm facing. You know, what is the guidance you have? And to the extent that you requested some no action, you know, relief, you know, that might be provided and provide clarity, not just to you, but actually to your competitors also in terms of what the rules of the road are, at least in terms of how investment management thinks about the issue. I don't know that you see it that much anymore. I think many have a reluctance, really, to go in and ask the questions, even when you're pretty sure you're right, and, you know, for fear not just that they might have a different view, but now they'll put it up as an item of interest or whatever they're calling that, so that without a full hearing, it's up with some of the analysis that was done without anybody really advocating.
Well, I'm struck by your point, buddy, about uncertainty, and I think it's a terrific one. And in fact, you know, it seems like over the last 5 years, you know, there's been so many moving regulations, not just the SEC's changing its rule book and the CFTC is changing its rule book, but the Europeans are changing their rule books, and the accounting boards and panels are changing the way they look at certain derivatives and other certain issues. So I think it's a very good point, because instead of sort of here's a single issue, I go in and I see the chief counsel in the investment management division and I persuade him or her, it's like, well, that's only sort of the start of the whole thing, because now you've got to figure out all these other regulatory bodies, legal and accounting, domestic and global.
So I said I wanted to drill down a little deeper on a couple of issues. I have to ask you about valuation, fund board's oversight of valuation of portfolio securities. What do you think the impact is of the Morgan Keegan case? What has changed, if anything, regarding valuation? I imagine one or more of you might have views on this one.
Well, I advise a number of boards, so I'm happy to take the first shot at this. And that is, I think the first thing that I've personally seen and talked to other board counsel about is that every board is going back and looking at their mutual fund's existing valuation policies, and then they're comparing what they think the Morgan Keegan case is about to their own policies to see whether there's any gaps. And so those are everyone's doing that from as far as I can tell. But after that, I think a lot of people are then sort of taking a stop, wait, let's look around. And I don't know of any firms offhand that are rushing to tweak their valuation policies. I think there's a feeling that the facts in Morgan Keegan were fairly sui generis, and that the securities in question were sort of the hardest of the hard to price part of the market. So they were mortgage-backed securities within the fixed income space. And therefore, in some ways, it was sort of the perfect storm in terms of a regime that counts on mark-to-market daily current valuation.
Tom, I'll take the other side for a moment. You know, if you have the view that those facts were compelling to bring a case, why would you ever settle for, essentially causing a violation of Rule 38A1. I mean, that was the violation. The violation was policies and procedures. That's the best. I mean, you know, you could read that and say, okay, fine. What's the most they're going to do? I'm going to get a cease and desist to not do this again. I mean, and there's a lot of dicta in there about all the bad things that you did, but none of them led to anything other than, you know, you got to follow your procedures, you got to have good procedures. Is that a fair reading of it? I mean, I was embarrassed that was the final outcome of that case.
It's pretty
differently.
When you look at all of the briefs that were filed and just weigh them, all the different experts that were used, and all of the and then you look at the final settlement, which, as you said, was a finding that the compliance policies around valuation were not up to snuff. It's a pretty the only way I can understand it is it's a message case. You know, beware directors, you can't can't fall asleep when facts really jump out at you that don't make sense.
But, I mean, for the group here, I mean, let's talk about message cases. I find them difficult in the sense that, yes, they're wake-up calls to everyone. And to the extent that you thought that behavior might have been way beyond the line, it doesn't help you know where the line is. It doesn't give clarity. And, you know, for books and records, you know, or for, you know, a policies and procedures case, you know, that certainly doesn't give clarity other than go back and look at your policies and procedures, and you always should do that. So, I mean, I would have found more compelling, actually, probably a speech given by Norm on it or something. I mean, that's where there could have been, you know, just a reminder of things you needed to do as opposed to an enforcement case that now enforcement cases do get everybody's attention. But then you have to deal with all the dicta that's in the enforcement case.
So what do you all think of that point? We talked earlier about supervisory responsibility, and I'd like to just see if we can marry this discussion with that one earlier today. Is that really the point of some of these cases? It's just to encourage firms, much the way a speech would, but in a far more robust manner, to encourage firms to go back and look at their procedures in a given area. Is that the point of the matter?
It certainly has that effect. I mean, Certainly in the valuation in the Morgan Keegan case, everyone did go back and look at their procedures. Everybody did go back and start questioning, you know, who's making the final decisions? What are the triggers for the fair value pricing? How often are stale prices reviewed? I'm also, as a sub-advisor to a lot of mutual funds, saying even though we don't price the funds, we oftentimes can provide input on a fair value securities, or we may get a call sort of saying, what are you doing for your accounts? A lot of sort of due diligence focused on what we're doing, how we're doing it. And I think it ties in some respects, just to the whole supervisory control sort of theme that seems to be emanating from a lot of these cases, that you have to have oversight and supervision, and you have to have due diligence, and you have to make sure that you know what it is that you're doing on an ongoing basis and be involved.
Yeah, I'd say, you know, firms supervise their employees and their officers. Boards oversight the firms. And this is an oversight case where the SEC said this oversight, in our view, was not enough.
I apologize because I don't know the answer to this. Was the CCO brought in?
The CCO was not.
Okay, so...
So yet another...
Did you skip a level?
Yet another thing, another interesting and sort of glaring aspect that just doesn't make sense to me.
I'm in favor of not bringing cases against CCOs.
I have to say I probably am too, but I...
Thank you, buddy.
But I'm also not in favor of skipping a level where there's a control that board should be able to rely on in terms of someone else doing...
Well, there was the whole notion that, I mean, there obviously people were reporting they were trolling for a case to bring against directors, and this seems to be the one they brought first and foremost.
Buddy, earlier in the evening you mentioned money market fund regulations. Without delving deeply into the substance, do you think the proposal, I mean, does the proposal really establish the SEC as the primary regulator of money market funds? Do you think that it's done that, and do you think adoption is likely? I'd ask each of the panelists if they have a view on the money market funds proposal.
Yeah, I mean, without getting into some of my views about the proposal, you do wonder when the cost-benefit analysis is on each item, whether or not it actually all fits together at the end. I am very concerned about the unintended consequences of the proposal, because the view is that the next problem we have is going to be exactly like the problem we had before, and therefore the solution would have worked without maybe anticipating that once you set out certain rules out there, people will change their behavior based on what the rule is, you may now have created another issue. My own sense is that some of the other regulators would have preferred some form of capital in one way or another to have been involved. But I think certainly if the SEC had not acted, they would have prompted other regulators to have to consider what they could do. Remember, FSOC had identified this as one of their major systemic risks that they had to deal with. And so if the SEC didn't have the capability of dealing with it, then I think FSOC, whether or not it wanted to, I think would have been compelled to do something. So, yes, in that regard, I think that they've reestablished it. This is not an easy question, and is one that, people who I highly respect have very different views about, number one, what the problem is, and then number two, what if there is that problem, what the solution should be, and then what other problems are being created by that solution. And so I think, if you take time and go in and read many of the comment letters when they're finally filed, I think you'll see that there's a wide range, really, of views that people have about the industry, about what the issues were, what they could be, and then about what the proposed solution should be. So a long way of saying that I think it does reestablish the SEC's primary role overseeing money market funds. But I would point out that I think most of the money market fund providers are also regulated by the Fed.
Tom, any views?
Yes, sir, thanks.
Well, it's interesting because it's a industry that worked very, very well for a long period of time. And now you see that it's shrunk tremendously in the last 5 years because of not necessarily regulatory issues, but because of just, the business didn't make sense anymore with all the subsidization of yields and whatnot that was going on. I mean, I think in response to your question, I do think that the SEC proposal sort of keeps the SEC as the primary regulator of money funds. And I think that's an important thing for the SEC to do. And I also agree that it's a tremendously complicated issue because you have different types of money funds within, different subspecies of money funds that are very different from other ones. And they're used in different ways. Some are used within the world of variable annuity funds, for example. Some are used in trust departments where you have to have, your principal has to be inviolate. So it's for a variety of reasons, it's a very complicated product, but one that, for years was an essential component of a successful money management firm. So it's an important product to get right.
Thanks, Tom. Our time is getting short. Let me ask just one quick question that I think is a big theme. We can't spend a lot of time on it because we have to close soon. Could you comment briefly on technology and on the dimensions of technology? Nancy, I think you've thought about this a bit. We don't have much time left, but if you're willing to just give us a quick view on technology, that could be very, I think, very interesting.
I think I'm sure everyone agrees it's technology is a big issue in the sense of somewhat of a lack of guidance coming out from the regulators, certainly the SEC, let's put it that way, in terms of what they're expecting of investment advisors in connection with investment models they use that are proprietary, models that they lease and are using, what kind of due diligence should they be doing with respect to those models when they're dealing with brokers, whose algorithms they're using, what kind of oversight should they have of those algorithms. I think there's guidance out there from other regulators. And I think, if you look at the Axel Rosenberg case, it was really a disclosure case with a lot of dicta on what people should be doing or thinking about in connection with their models. So I think it's an area that investment advisors are trying to grapple with because technology is everywhere and you have to sort of step back and think about what you have to prioritize and what you have to focus on. But I think it's a huge resource right now in terms of managers that use any of these kinds of models. The other thing, just if I look even across the ocean at the SFC in Asia, just has a proposal out that's requiring investment managers who utilize algorithms of brokers that they deal with to actually implement an appropriate due diligence oversight with respect to those algorithms. And interestingly enough, they didn't put that burden on the broker-dealers. They put it on the advisors. But we know it's here. We know it's going to actually focus and garner a lot of attention mostly because of failures that have occurred on a number of the exchanges, Facebook being one of the big issues, but just stale data, et cetera, that just shut down the exchanges. So I think there's a lot more to come in this area. There's a lot more that's going to develop from an SEC perspective.
Nancy, thank you very much. I think that has to be the final word. Nancy, Buddy, and Tom, all of you, thank you very much for sharing your insights and experiences. I hope everyone found this to be an informative discussion on current issues in asset management. Today's program will be a valuable addition to the body of knowledge in the Bingham Presents series. An audio of the broadcast will be available soon in the virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org, and an edited transcript will be added later. Bingham's website will also have a transcript of today's discussion. On behalf of the SEC Historical Society, I would like to thank Bingham for their sponsorship and hospitality in making today's program possible. Thanks also to our audiences who have gathered here in Bingham's offices in New York and who have joined us online. Good evening and goodbye for now.